Best Moments episode of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudelli sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudelli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month. I have to admit, when I first read the announcement on this, you guys were announcing futures products for Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Litecoin, and Ethereum. They're all going to be physically delivered. And at first, I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I'd like to see all of these cryptos having futures on them. But when I really took note was when I saw the investors, the partners on the list. You had DRW, Virtu, and TD. So those are a few of the biggest fish in the industry. So talk to us about this partnership.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think we're beyond thrilled to have the roster of investors that came on board with us. I think it's not only a statement of support from folks who know what they're talking about, but I also think it underscores the message of what we're trying to do at ErisX. We want to build a safe, transparent, intermediary-friendly marketplace for people to trade spot crypto and futures. And certainly, you know, someone like TD coming in starts to show you that there's demand out there, and that demand is going to come from places that maybe aren't active in the market today. I think a lot of people obviously have accounts in other platforms and they trade, but you can't log into a platform you know, love, and are comfortable with and start to trade these products today. And the fact that they've invested and are locking arms and arms with us to partner is a great testament to what we're building and what it could be. Then you bring in name brands, people who have a track record of success, like DRW, like Virtu, and so many of the others that you would have seen on our release. We're just beyond thrilled that they're on board with us, not only as investors, but partnering with us to make sure we build the best market we can.
Yeah, now at ErisX, you guys are going to have a DCM, which is a license to operate a futures exchange, and you're also going to have a DCO license, which is a license to operate a clearing firm. So when I was reading about that was very interesting to me, because that means that you're going to be very similar to a Coinbase, but also very different because of those licenses. Talk to everybody about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, Aris today has a DCM, and that's been in operation for close to 8 years. It's a great track record. We know what it means to run a regulated market, and we're going to be repurposing that, of course, for purposes of crypto. Now, spot isn't regulated by the CFTC, but we're going to be operating our spot market under the same constructs of surveillance and transparency. So we have the DCM, and as you said, that's what we need to operate the exchange, so a CFTC-regulated futures exchange requires that license. The DCO is to operate the clearinghouse, and that's an application we have in process. The commission published our application a few weeks back, so that's out there in the public domain. Again, we'll be offering spot and futures on the same platform. We need these licenses to operate the futures components of it. Certainly, there's other places to trade, as you know, but from our perspective, having these licenses shows that we're committed to being regulated and transparent about how our market operates with a rule book that people can see and what have you. And B, we think there's some counterparts that either by internal decision or by mandate just aren't going to be able to transact on platforms that aren't regulated, that aren't transparent. And we think that having these two licenses isn't just a nice to have. We think it's critical to our story.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that there's other places for people to go and trade. And the one question I have with all of these futures markets coming out on cryptos now, and all, you know, more spot exchanges, are you worried that it's going to get diluted? Like, well, what makes you believe that your products are going to have the liquidity needed, you know, for your clients and customers?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're not going to own 100% of the market, and we're aware of that, but we think that by A, providing trading in a regulated environment, as we just talked about, B, sizing the spot and futures contracts to be sizes accessible to market participants that can't get in it today. Some of the products that are out there today are quite large notionally in the cash settled future space. So we think by sizing the products appropriately and then bringing in people to really make a market, having a bunch of professional trading groups in your market is necessary and something we need to have, and we have great support in that regards. But you need to have people that are trading for different reasons over different time horizons and different sizes to truly make a market. So we think that by bringing in TD Ameritrade, by bringing in institutional FCMs to help bring their clients along, you would have seen EDNF Man on our press release as well, and there'll be some more names you'll be hearing about as we trundle on towards end of the year here. We think by bringing in different counterparts that have different reasons to trade and having different sizes, we'll start to create a more liquid and interesting market. And then for people that haven't sort of joined on early, if we make a market that's liquid and deep and tight, then even if you're on another platform, you're going to want to connect and trade with us as well.
What I like about what you're saying is that you've personalized this. You're not going by the book, just following what an indicator is saying should happen. You go beyond that and you're, to me, building a theme in the market. You're looking at multiple indicators for confirmations, and then you decide whether or not you want to step into that market, if it's a good look to you. And I think this is so important for everybody out there listening. I mean, here's somebody like you who's been studying technical analysis for many years, and you don't go by the book. You've personalized your strategy. You're not just living and dying by one indicator. So let's take it a step further. I talk about execution all the time. To me, it doesn't matter if you have the greatest strategy under the sun, you now have to execute it. So take us through a current example of you identifying something through your indicators and then getting to the point of executing it.
Okay, so for example, you know, I turned bearish on the market right around the middle part of September. And initially, you know, it's important to see a few different things. One is that if you're gonna try to make a counter trend play, which is in this case what I wanted to do as the markets were entering September, you saw a tremendous amount of bullish sentiment, and that was really key initially. You started to see negative divergences also, and those were important. You saw stocks moving to new high territory, but yet momentum really didn't follow suit, and so that was the second part of the equation. The third is that the breadth really started to drop off pretty substantially, and so that was also important in terms of looking at that. And the final ingredient, or the final couple of ingredients, one was that I wanted to see personally see S&P show evidence of counter trend type sell signals or exhaustion developing on the uptrend. So you saw that right into the middle part of September, and that really gave you a pretty decent at least a confluence of a lot of different things coming together. Not only seasonality was poor, but sentiment was very bullish. Negative divergence was present. The breadth had started to go down substantially, starting really back in the latter part of August. Advanced decline had peaked and started down. The last element in really that equation is price. And price, of course, is the most important indicator of all. I mean, you really need price to break before you can really initiate any type of trade. And so for me, you know, I tend to be a little shorter term in how I look at things. My time frame is not, you know, multi-months or years, but when I'm gonna initiate a trade, I'll look at things, I'll generally use daily charts and use hourly charts. And so, you know, daily charts of the S&P, for example, the last, you know, major swing low we saw really was at the latter part of June, and it started higher by then, making it higher and higher moves in price, but yet momentum gradually started to drop off. But it was really during the day of almost, I believe, early October, October the 4th, when S&P broke. And it's really the act of breaking the 2 to 3 month uptrend when all the other factors are in place that really put everything together to say, okay, the market is finally, price is finally starting to confirm what all these other indicators have been suggesting could happen for the last month. And so that's just one example. But historically, you know, and the S&P at that time was right around, you know, 2920, I believe, is when it broke. And so when it broke that trend, that was the first key that I really wanted to be focused more on being short. And then really when it broke September lows, that was really a much bigger thing. And that really helped the market to start to accelerate at a time when, you know, really people were least expecting it, I believe. So, but oftentimes my trades will involve the start of divergence, positive or negative, you know, depending on whether I'm buying or selling, and really the presence of DeMarc tools where something will get, you know, for example, if I'm buying into a dramatic pullback within an uptrend, I like buying things really two ways. Either the chart looks fantastic, it's moved up for years, and then it starts to base for maybe 2, 3, 4 months and does nothing. And then the stock all of a sudden starts to break those former highs, be it daily, weekly, monthly, and does so on very good volume. And so that's a really a type A type chart that I really want to be focused on. The other is when I use DeMarc in a way where I'll wait for counter trend buy signals to emerge in really oversold conditions, but yet with divergence within an ongoing intermediate term uptrend, but when the daily trend is broken. So you have a severe sell-off that falls over a period of time, but then it hits a key level of intermediate term support. And so to initiate those trades, you really have to rely on weekly and or monthly charts and wait. So where the daily is very oversold, sentiment very bearish, but based on maybe put to call data on a certain stock, and you see a rapid, a lot of puts being traded all of a sudden, but it's coming into a decent level of support and you're starting to get DeMarc indications of exhaustion. So when I see those line up, that really is a great chance to really buy dips. So, I mean, those are really two different examples of how I would use, you know, my tool set to really trade something not only that's breaking out to new high territory, but also to really buy dips of something that is plummeting and nobody wants to be involved with it. But, you know, I look at the weekly charts and they're in good shape. It's really just daily damage. And so for me, that's the importance of using multiple time frames and saying, okay, it might look bad on a daily basis, but when you look at the weekly and the monthly, it's actually in very good shape. And so it might just be, you know, things like MACD or RSI are trending down. MACD is trending down, has rolled over, broken the signal line. RSI has been trending lower, is closing in on oversold. But yet the weekly and the monthly, the momentum is still in decent shape. And so that is really the bread and butter as to how I would make a trade of that sort. And to get back to your other point, I mean, you mentioned, you know, some of these indicators, and you know, there are thousands of indicators these days. And so I would encourage people to, you know, to really try to figure out a way that you can combine several different indicators to be successful. Like, I'm not an indicator guy. I don't look at buying, initiating a trade just because I see a crossover and a moving average. You know, I think very little of buying something just because it hits a 200-day moving average, for example. I mean, some people look at those things and they spread them around the trading desk as if they're the holy grail. But, it, you know, it really is, it's going to be more dependent on price and time coming together more than just a moving average itself, which really has very little value. I would argue if something gets way above or below a moving average, that has more value when the moving average starts to turn than really across itself of a certain moving average. So anyway, the indicators, when back-tested, most of them have about a coin flip rate of success. And so as you mentioned, you know, why read the books? They give you the standard formula of how to use an RSI and MACD, and are these really all that worthwhile? Well, I would argue, you know, it's really the way you apply them, and the divergences are more important than just something being overbought or oversold by itself, though that itself has really very little value. But when people realize that really time has a much bigger effect than price, so, you know, a Fibonacci level might have very little value. You know, 38.2, 61.8, what do those actually mean? But if price has gone from 0 to 100 in 100 days and then corrects 38 days and corrects 38 points, I'll tell you what, that has a heck of a lot more importance. And so it's really trying to put things together in a way that very few people have done that can really add a lot of value when you have a confluence of a lot of different things coming together to really make for the perfect setup.
So you've already mentioned Trump and the Fed, and obviously this is something that I think the market has seriously been taking a look at because the president talks about this so often, and he says that the Fed is just going loco. Those are his words, right? It's going crazy. Right. What do you think about him saying that?
Well, I don't think that the president should be getting involved with monetary policy. There needs to be some independence of the Fed. Do I think the Fed's misguided in what they're doing? Yes, we can talk about that in a second. But I also think the president needs to stay out of monetary policy. There needs to be an independence between these two. And of course, you know, the reality is, and you know this and I know this, is that there's really not. The Federal Reserve has always worked at the behest of politics to a degree, because in order to pass economic policy, in order to pass fiscal policy, you need a market that's working. And in order for people that are in power to stay in power, they need markets that are working. So, you know, with elections that are coming up in November, this sell-off in October may have an impact on the actual election. People vote with their pocketbooks, right? People's economic outlooks is based on what's happening in the economy and happening in the markets. So when you're talking about record confidence levels, you're talking about record consumer confidence levels, record investment confidence levels, record business confidence levels. Well, that's all because we've had this boom in economic growth. A lot of it's been artificially driven by a lot of fiscal stimulus. We're running nearly a $1 trillion deficit in 2018. That will be $1.5 trillion moving into 2019. By the way, you only run $1 trillion deficits in recessions, not expansions, which tells you a little bit more about what's happening in the real economy. But secondly, the point is that you have those record confidence levels are what you see at peaks of market cycles, not the beginning of a market cycle. So the Federal Reserve potentially is operating in very dangerous territory by continuing to hike rates. They're trying to do that not because they believe the economy is going to be taking off onto a massive growth expansionary run. Their long-term estimates are 2% on economic growth. So at 2% economic growth, why are you hiking rates above that growth rate? Interest rates are a reflection of economic growth, period, right? You go back through history, interest rates in the 10-year treasury run about the level of economic growth over time. So why on earth are you continuing to hike rates if you expect a 2% growth rate in the economy? Because the Fed knows, as well as you and I know, that eventually the cycle will end and we're going to have a recession, and their best tool for fighting a recession is being able to drop interest rates. They have got to get as far away from zero as possible in order to have that tool available. They understand that they're potentially hiking themselves right into a recession. The problematic issue with Trump getting involved is that if he stops them from getting as far away from zero as possible, it will limit the tools available for that recession when it comes.
So, and I agree with you on what you're saying. You're saying the Fed is hiking themselves basically into a recession. So this way they can potentially cut rates if we get into a recession. It just seems
right. You got to have it seems weird, but it's the lesser of two evils. If you have a recession at zero, right, then the recession is going to be really, really, really bad. I mean, we're talking about a depressionary type recession because there's no policy tool available for the Federal Reserve to use at that point. They don't have the ability to go to negative rates yet. That's going to require some congressional approval. And whether or not they'll get that's a different story, considering what we've got going on in politics right now. So their best bet is to get as far away from zero. It's the lesser of two evils. Yes, I potentially hike into a recession, but I have the ability to stave off some of the decline by having a tool available. They don't have the ability to do a tremendous amount of QE. The world expansion that's been done on QE has basically come to an end. So we're now in a contractionary basis on QE, which leaves that tool and the efficacy of that tool potentially at some risk.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. Well, Terry, I mentioned earlier that I think you're a visionary. You've been on the pulse of the market since you started about what the new technologies and the next big thing is going to be in the industry. What are your thoughts on cryptos and blockchain?
I think it's the next big thing. I think you have to separate those from just a moment, not that both of them won't be big. But I think that blockchain, distributed ledger technology, is absolutely going to change our world. I mean, I wish I had, you know, 40 or 50 more years to see what comes of it. Because, you know, I remember doing stories, I know this sounds ancient, guys, but I've been around for a bit, when the Federal Reserve had helicopters landing on the roof on LaSalle Street, bringing in literally bags of checks, canceled checks. And you deposited a check from an out-of-town or out-of-state bank, and you had to wait 5 to 7 days for your money. That's the float. Somebody was getting rich off that float. Today, still, I deposited a check recently from one Chicago bank to another. They said you get $200 today, immediate cash. I mean, and I'm me. I've never overdrawn my account. But that's the deal. You put it in, and $4,800 of this $5,000 check would be available the next day. Well, blockchain technology will eliminate the float. That'll upset a lot of people. And it will create complete security of transactions. And you think about, when you go buy a house, you need title insurance, because who knows if someone hasn't made a claim years past. We don't keep the records. But a distributed ledger technology will do that. It's coming. It's going to change everything from how Walmart figures out what salmonella is in the lettuce to how property is transferred. It's so exciting. And the cryptocurrencies, the real weakness in crypto is the points at which you transfer your U.S. dollars or euros or yen into, you know, there's 2,000 cryptocurrencies. But just the immediate problem with it is, well, in a word, Mt. Gox. But did you just see recently Fidelity announced that it was going to create a platform for cryptocurrencies and yep. hold custody of them? So that changes that game of cryptos. Now, we'll see which ones become more valuable in their usage. We'll see. I mean, it's so exciting, but it really is coming fast.
What trader has influenced your life the most and why?
Vincent J. Schreiber is the gentleman. He has since passed away, one of the nicest human beings I've ever met in my entire life. He had a lot of faith in me when I was a young 19, 20-year-old where I met him. He was very successful. He retired early, but he never forgot where he came from. And that's what influenced me the most. Vince came from nothing, made his way to somebody, and that's something I will never, ever forget. And that's why I never forget where I came from, never will. And he was the one that taught me great discipline at a young age. I had a very bad trading incident when I first started, and I thought Vince was gonna write me a check. He says, I'm not gonna write you a check, I'm gonna give you my reputation. And if you walk away, I'll pay it, but you're not gonna walk away. And it taught me, what he did it for was to teach me discipline at a young age. So he had the biggest impact on my life. I think of him almost on a daily basis still today.
He's a true legend, Terry. What was one of the hardest things for you to overcome in trading?
Saying you're wrong. You know, it's for any trader to admit they're wrong, it's just not natural. So you have to blame everybody else. And I think being in a situation early in my career where I had these issues, where I had lost money and I had to say, listen, the market is bigger than any one individual. And if, as long as you can admit that you're wrong, you'll get much farther ahead. But most traders say, I'm not wrong, the market's wrong. I'm not wrong, my timing's wrong. I'm not wrong, that's the problem. Well, if you lost money, you're wrong, is the way I look at it. So I think that's it, admitting when you're wrong.
Throughout your long career as a trader, Terry, how did your trading process evolve?
You know, it evolved really from very humble. I leased a membership when I was 21 years old, started trading a couple of small ones and twos, got into the customer business because somebody was busy back then. They asked me to help them out for a day. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I said, I'll help. And that went to the next step, and then I started to develop a large client business and a following out of New York and Chicago with the big books of business. And you know, that's how I built my business over the 23-year span that I did it for before I took over as chairman, then eventually CEO as well.
What is one attribute that you believe every trader should have?
Discipline. Discipline, discipline, discipline. Anthony, it sounds cliche, but if you can sit there and literally be honest with yourself and not let a machine tell you what you're doing or not doing, right or wrong, and have a little discipline, I think you'll be wildly successful in the long run. And there's never, if you're a short-term, near-term thinker, you might make money one day, you might money 2 days, but eventually you will lose. So you have to have a long horizon about how you want to have your career going, whether you're in any field of, whether it's medicine or anything else. But in financial services, I think people get very short-sighted and they want instant gratification. And that's the world we live in today. So you have to have a view for the long haul. So that's what I would think that would help be helpful to traders.
Favorite book you've read lately?
Is Bob Woodward here yet? I can't wait to read that book. So lately, my books that I read are far and few between because I have to read anywhere between 20 and 100 pages a day of reports. So I read a book a day, except a lot of them don't have good endings.
What's the best advice that you've received about trading?
Best advice I ever received about trading was somebody sent me to talk to somebody in 1987, and he was a legendary trader when I was in a bit of a rut. You know, I had money, but it was a bit of a rut. And the best advice I got was sit down and listen to this gentleman for an hour, and they said that in that hour, there'll be 1 minute of brilliance. It's up for you to figure out where the 1 minute comes from. So I sat there for an hour, listened to this gentleman, and I didn't hear much of anything. So I went back to my friend and I said, you know, I didn't get the 1 minute of brilliance. He goes, you didn't hear the 1 minute of brilliance? I said, no. He says, you know what, you did get it. I go, how did I get it? He goes, you became a better listener than a talker.
That's great. Terry, if you can go back in time and give the younger you a piece of advice, what would it be?
The younger people a piece of advice?
No, if you can go back in time and give the younger you a piece of advice. What would it be?
Probably lighten up on the tattoos. Let's see. Oh, teasing. Younger me, a bit of advice. Take a little better care of yourself when you're younger, because it's amazing. You never think you're going to get older. You know, when you're in your 20s and you're bulletproof and you're trading, you think nothing's, and then all of a sudden you're 60. Enjoy it. I would tell a younger Terry, enjoy life more than you have. But I've always been nose down, hard, and going. I would tell myself to lighten up a little bit.
Last question for today, Terry. What's your favorite thing to do when you're not working?
Be with my wife and kids.
Terry, this was great. Thank you so much for joining me on Futures Radio.
Appreciate you very much. Thank you.
I mean, the volatility in natural gas almost makes equities look like they're not that busy. So, Brent, talk to us. What's going on in natural gas?
We've had a big move, right? And the velocity of this move from $3 to almost $5 has really harkens back to 10, 15 years ago. I think it was breathtaking. And I like to try to frame up what's happened in the last several weeks by just taking everybody back a little. And, you know, this is a market where we all sat around all summer and watched the weekly storage numbers come across. And week after week after week, the mantra has been, we're X percent below 5-year average inventories. We are, you know, record low inventories for this time of year. And it really did nothing to move the market. For the whole summer, really since February, we've sat in a range of around, you know, $2.70 to $3. And so we've had kind of this perception or complacency that there's a production story that negates the storage story. And even though it hasn't really sat right with people and they've really felt like we should make, you know, this market should make a move higher, it's all about timing, right? It took its own sweet time and waited until we got to the winter demand months. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of factors lined up and the market, you know, just, even though it's been anticipating it, I think it was caught really off guard in the way that they were overall positioned.
To me, it sounds like you were seeing signs that this could happen, but obviously, like you just said, a lot of people were caught off guard with this move.
I would say that people have been anticipating a bull move in natural gas, and yet the market hasn't been moving. And so what became really apparent is the way people were structuring their bets for a move higher in you know, due to weather and storage. And the way they were structuring their bets, and people were all on the same side of the boat. They were long the first few contracts of the winter strip, and the winter strip is November through March. And so November and December and even January is where length was being placed. And March is where kind of that short leg was being placed. And this is a market that has looked back at history over the last 5 years and watched March settle under April. It's watched January perform and then the rest of the winter sell off. And so what you started to see was typically you would have the front couple contracts trade below the January and February contracts. And they started moving above. They started, you had December over February, and they started moving out to levels that were, you know, if you put together any historical charts, and certainly I posted, you know, a bunch myself, they were at highs. And so it was clear, and in every recommendation you saw, people were, they wanted to be long, but they wouldn't just commit to being outright long. So they bought the front and they sold March. And what happened was that finally came, that, you know, that bill came due. And when it, cash was strong every day, the market, you know, kept reacting to cold weather. There wasn't any real selling off. Everyone who was short March ran to that contract at 50 cents below, 30 cents below February, and just went to buy it back. And that has just kept a bid in the front of this market.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.